STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Oh my gosh, turn the volume up in these headphones.
Oh, that was Annabeth.
Oh, when the music went off, it was just like an explosion.
Well, I'm glad she's laughing. Oh, by the way, this is Melinda Penner, STR Ask. I am Greg Kokel. She's out of control right now.
I'm being controlled.
This is a good start for it.
You're just looking for any opportunity to take over on this podcast, aren't you? I'm Melinda the Enforcer. This is Greg Kolko. This is the STR Ask podcast. Where do you turn the volume down on this?
I was rescuing you. No, that's the volume right there, I think.
Oh, golly.
But
geez.
See, that's Melinda. Annabeth was listening just a few hours ago, that's probably the adjustment.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was when Justin Brierley was here last week. But
maybe,
anyway, the volume was up on her headset, and that
bad.
Little tune
just
almost
blasted.
Blew her. I was listening to it, enjoying the little rock and roll. I'm doing my air guitar. And it's too bad because this little camera now, as we're filming this, recording it, was on me because we don't have a wide-end lens. But you were the one that they should have been watching because that was really funny.
Yeah, Greg just mentioned video recording this. What we're going to start doing is not posting the video of this entire thing, but taking the question and the answer and posting those individually as videos online.
And also, like things like this, when Melinda gets really freaked out or she laughs really hard or something dumb, or
I'm
throwing spitball.
So there's nothing to post.
Well, it's still, you
this
know,
is a
people
short
can
podcast.
Imagine.
Let's just move on, okay?
All right.
All right. So.
It'll make it more fun, though, if we actually see the actions, the animations.
Well, you're
the
usually
antics.
The funny one, or at least trying to be the funny one.
Yeah, but okay.
Okay. So this is our short
not
podcast.
The funny looking one.
Greg's on a timer. Ethics, values, and religion in 4 minutes or less. It is possible. Hmm. It actually is.
Got my timer right here.
You post us your questions. Yep. You post us the questions on Twitter using hashtag STRask. You post your questions on Twitter using hashtag STRask. You're not going to divert me. We post new episodes every Monday and Thursday. So let's get going. First question comes from Twitter, Jay Odermatt. Open your Bible up, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Malachi 3:10.
As you wish. Malachi, wait a minute, it's going to take a while to find. Oh, that's the it's the Malachi. He's the Italian one. All right, he's right at the end. All right.
In Malachi 3:10, is Malachi 3:10 and surrounding verses still in effect, or was it person or context, history specific to the audience there?
Well, 3:10. There goes that tick-tock, tick-tock. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my house, and test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if you'll not open the windows of heaven and pour out for your blessing until it overflows. This is a favorite of pastors, but I think it's misused every time. And the reason is because there is no obligation for Christians to tithe. The tithe is not attached to any agreement that Christians have, Gentiles have, with God. The tithe is a function of the Mosaic law. There is a reason for it, and that is because the nation of Israel was a theocracy that needed money to operate, not just the spiritual aspects, but the civic aspects as well. And so the tithe, which actually wasn't just one-tenth, it was more than that, as it turns out. I think John MacArthur said it turned out to be more like 30% because tithes were given at different times in different ways. Tenthing was done. It wasn't just one-tenth for the whole year, and then you're covered. It was more than that. But the point is that that was an arrangement that was made between God and the Jews under the theocracy. There is no repeat of the obligation to tithe in the New Testament under a New Testament or a New Covenant situation. And I know people say, well, they go back to Matthew and Matthew 25 or Matthew 23 rather, and there is Jesus condemning the Jews because you tithe mint, dill, and cumin, but you ignore the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy and the like. These things you should have done without neglecting the others. And they say, see, there you go. You should have done that. You should have tithed. But if they look at the beginning of the chapter, he's saying to the people, he says, everything that the leaders the rabbis, the Pharisees, tell you to do. These do, just don't do as they do. So if that verse 25 or whatever it is, where later on where he's talking about tithe applies to us, so does the earlier part of that same discourse. He is talking to Jews under the theocracy. And so they are to obey the Jewish leaders as to the law which they are under, but they aren't to be hypocritical like them. And the tithe was one of those laws they were under, but no, we are no longer under that, neither Jews nor Gentiles. So there's no obligation to tithe. Now, do we have an obligation to give? Yes. And Paul talks about in Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, but similar kinds of promises are made that when we give, it shall be given to you, pressed down, shaken together, overflowing in your lap. Jesus says in the Gospels, in the Proverbs, it says, cast your bread upon the water and it'll return to you. I think that's a proverb, or it's somewhere in the text. The point is that God is...
It's a song by the Imperials, too.
Pardon me?
It's a song by the Imperials,
too. Oh, it is. Okay. The point is that the principle of giving is still there, and the principle of receiving from God in response to our generosity is still there. We see it in the Philippians, where the Philippians help Paul financially, and Paul says, and God will help you. You know, God will provide all your needs according to his riches in Christ Jesus. I think it's chapter 4:19 or whatever. The point is that when they give to Paul, God will respond and give to them. So the principle that we see here of giving and being given back by God is still in place, but the particular issue of tithing is not in place because no responsibility of tithing applies to any Gentile. It's part of the Mosaic Law. And since the Mosaic Law is not even incumbent upon Jews, it doesn't apply to them either. Now, some people say, wait a minute, Abraham tithed. Before the law, he tithed, and he tithed to Melchizedek. If you look closely at the passage, he takes one-tenth of the spoils, which were his full portion, because there were other people that fought with him this battle, and they all divided up. He gets one-tenth, and he gave the whole one-tenth to Melchizedek, and he says, I don't want anybody to say that the Gentiles prospered me. So he gave 100%, not 10%. His portion was 10% of the spoil. He gave 100% of that to Melchizedek. So you don't really have an example of tithing, even in that particular circumstance. The principle of giving is still in place, and we are to give as we have been prospered and with a joyful heart, not legalistically by demand. And that's Paul's directions in 2 Corinthians. So I think we can safely overlook the Malachi passage, which applied to someone else. If we are preaching on it, we could say, yes, this is a provision of the law. The New Testament giving is still, voluntary giving is the pattern, and the principle of given it shall be given to you that we see there in Malachi is also a New Testament principle as well.
Okay, great. Next question comes from Emily Mattson. It's my understanding that elders and deacons are established to monitor the church. Why are so many pastors going astray then?
Well, that's a real good question. And interestingly, just 2 days ago, I was reading about this. It's in 1 Timothy chapter 2 when it talks about choosing elders and deacons. And elders and deacons are different. Elders rule the church. Deacons are servants. I mean, that's the biblical pattern. In some places in the South, deacons are doing the job of elders, or they call their elders deacons. I think it's confusing, but at least they have those that are ruling the church. Unfortunately, what happens in a lot of places is those titles are simply that, titles, and they don't have responsibility to really govern the church. It's the pastor who's doing the governance. So you have one leader that's governing. This is a big mistake. This happened later on in the history of the church, too, when bishops of regions became the leaders. And this is not what the New Testament intended. Bishops were simply, it's just another, I'm trying to think of the Greek word. I can't think of it right now, but basically the word that was translated bishop was the same one for elders. And so you had a multiplicity of individuals, multiple leaders in a local church, elders that were guiding the church. We have the same principle with stand a reason. We have men that are guiding the church that are elders, function like elders for the organization. We're not a church, but we still function under the same pattern.
And we still desire to be under accountability. Exactly. We're required by law, but we also desire it.
I'm an elder here at Stand to Reason. I'm on the board, but I have one vote.
You are elderly.
But I have just one vote, just like everybody else. So I'm not a super elder, you know, like I can veto everybody else's voting. No. And this protects me and it protects the organization, and it ought to be functioning that way in the local church to protect both the pastor and the church. But often it isn't.
I've noticed some friends who've been part of church plants that sometimes there's just such a small pool of people, and because they're doing a lot of evangelism, they're pulling in a lot of new Christians and young Christians, and there just isn't enough of a pool of mature Christian men in the congregation to be good elders. Mm-hmm. And I just think, you know, that needs to be part of the criteria, I would think, if you know, there's going to be a church plant. You need to have wise, mature Christian men who can be the elders. You can't rely on young Christians.
Well, think of it. If they're going to church plant, then maybe the elder board should be part, an elder board should be part of the plant. You don't just send out a pastor and his wife. You send out a group of people who will be the elders because they're of the maturity. But there's another thought here, and that is because in the early church, when churches were planted, keep in mind that you don't have a lot of mature people, but you need to have a leadership in those churches that Paul planted. And that's why he sent Timothy and Titus out to choose elders. But it's interesting when you look at the list of qualifications. The qualifications were largely character qualifications.
That's true.
And so what they were choosing was from among people who were rather younger Christians, but they were mature people, so that they had these character qualifications. They weren't given to alcohol. They weren't given to illicit gain, financial gain. They weren't troublemakers. They weren't people who started strife. You know, they were peaceable. So you see these character qualifications.
I had good stable families.
Stable families and the like. And so sometimes in church plants, I think you have a similar situation where you're going to get the best people you can that are mature people, that they don't have counts against them, so to speak. But they still needed to have the ability to teach. That is, they still had to understand foundational doctrine in order to be able to protect against the false teaching that was scattered around the Mediterranean region at that time. I think it's still a good principle.
Next question comes from Big Demarest. Does the persuasiveness, or you're going to love this one, it's right up your alley. Does the persuasiveness or persistence of our prayers ever determine the outcome? Does God not act because we stopped praying?
Well, I can only go back to the text for this, and it does seem that Jesus teaches, I think it's in Luke, and he talks about the unjust judge, and he talks about the persistence of the woman made a huge difference in the response, made the difference in the responsiveness of the judge, even though he is an unjust judge. Now, some people are going to say, well, God is not an unjust judge, so this isn't teaching by comparison, but rather by contrast. If even an unjust judge will do this and respond to a petition that is consistent and persistent, well, how much more will God respond? And I don't know if I buy that entirely. I do agree that there's a difference. God isn't the unjust judge. But when you read the tone of that particular parable, that teaching, it just seems to be that Jesus is encouraging people to continue and to press forward in prayer and wonders if faith will still be found when he returns. So there's some application there at the end, statements he makes. But I do think that it makes a difference. Sometimes, you know, you can pray one time, and that's all it takes. Other times, you persist over a long period of time. I know sometimes people have prayed for years for something or for someone until finally God responds and by their testimony answers the prayer. So, you know, that's, you said it's a good one for me because I think prayer is a conundrum, and it's just hard to it's hard to quantify what is the metric that's involved there. Is it the man's spirituality? Is it the number of times that the person is praying? Is it the number of prayers that are being prayed? You know, how does that work? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. James said it is the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man that avails much. Well, so there's fervency that's indicated in the metric of the outcome. And then we look at the example he gave was Elijah, and Elijah had to pray 8 times before finally the big rainstorm came, you know. And this is another mystery to me. So I think the lesson is, let it not be said of us that we have not because we ask not. Let's ask with as much faith as we have and then trust God for the outcome.
We were, because in the longer podcast that we recorded before this, you had a question about prayer, and Brooke, our engineer, and I were talking a little bit about this idea of faith, and I was thinking, well, maybe in those situations, we're talking about healing and those mm-hmm. that. And I was thinking maybe a synonym for faith in that context is expectation. Pray with expectation.
Right, right, yeah. And there's other verses in the Gospels where you see just that. Pray expecting to receive. And those are hard ones for me because it's hard for me to generate the expectation, mm-hmm. especially when times you've gotten close to it and it wasn't rewarded. So that's kind of an enigma. The one that matters to me most, the verse, is the one where the man whose son is demon-possessed comes to Jesus and says, I believe, help thou my unbelief. And that's the way I feel. Well, I have a measure of belief, but I also have some doubts. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the whole thing to Jesus and let him sort it out. Mm-hmm. Let him decide.
Sounds like good advice. Okay, so that's it for this week, folks. You can send us your questions on Twitter. Use hashtag STRS, the name of the podcast. We post 2 new episodes every week, Mondays and Thursdays. It's available in the usual places like STR.org, iTunes, and the STR app. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at STR.org.